Mark Stein's Poem of the Week.
Here's some rhymes for the times as we go from bad to verse. The statues in Parliament Square at Westminster are of British subjects, whether from home or abroad. That's to say, there are English Prime Ministers, Lord Palmerston and Sir Robert Peel, and certain Commonwealth figures, such as two sons of South Africa, Field Marshal Smuts and Nelson Mandela. Parliament Square's only foreigner, as that term is defined in British law, is the statue of Abraham Lincoln, a gift from America, unveiled in 1920 by the Duke of Connaught. A few days ago, it was vandalized and defaced with the initials BLM and with apparently worthier names, such as Michael Brown of Ferguson fame. I wonder whether the rampaging mob had any idea who Lincoln is. Here is a poem by one of the first famous writers of America's Pacific Northwest. Ella Higginson became a published author in 1875 at the age of 14, when the Oregon City Enterprise accepted her poem Dreams of the Past. She wrote poetry and short stories and essays, almost all from her home in Bellingham, Washington. She was also the first female campaign manager for the first female member of the Washington State Legislature, Frances Axtell, a cousin of Grover Cleveland. This poem was written three decades after Lincoln's assassination, and it never mentions his name because it doesn't need to. The first statue to Lincoln was of plaster, unveiled in San Francisco in 1866, the year after his death, soon replaced by a metal version, which was consumed in the fire following the 1906 earthquake. So the earliest statue still with us is in Washington from 1868, standing outside what's now, of all unworthy venues, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, in the presence of whose third-rate jurists I have had the misfortune to find myself. The famous Lincoln Memorial in Washington would not be completed until 1922. So this is a poem by Mrs. Higginson about someone who wishes to have the skills to sculpt purely in order to sculpt someone worthy of being memorialized in such a form. First published by Macmillan in 1898, from When the Birds Go North Again, by Ella Higginson, a poem called simply The Statue. That I might chisel a statue, line on line, out of a marble's chaste severities, angular, harsh, no softened curves to please, set tears within the eyes to make them shine, and furrows on the brow, deep, stern, yet fine. Gaunt, awkward, tall, no courtier of ease, the trousers bulging at the bony knees. Long nose, large mouth, but ah, the light divine of truth, the light that set a people free, burning upon it in a steady flame, as sunset fires a white peak on the sky. Ah, God, to leave it nameless and yet see men looking weep and bow themselves and cry, enough, enough! We know thy statue's name. A poem from me to you by Ella Higginson upon a statue left nameless, yet all know thy statue's name. They did in 1898. In the London of 2020, they know not and they care not. The most famous statue obsessive in history, mythology, culture, is Pygmalion, a sculptor and also king of Cyprus, rather in the way that Princess Louise was a sculptress and also a princess and vicegerent of Canada. Unlike Princess Louise, Pygmalion fell in love with his sculpture, a sculpture of a beautiful woman whose name eventually emerged some centuries later as Galatea. Hear from Franz von Suppe's operetta Die Schöne Galatea, The Beautiful Galatea, is a rather nice brass transcription of its famous overture. Brassimo Vienna with their version of Franz von Suppe's overture to his hit operetta of 1869, Die Schöne Galatea, The Beautiful Galatea. When the world is woke, there's a lot to be said for sleep. Deep sleep. Oblivion. Where Chairman Xi and Justin Trudeau and AOC and Anthony Fauci cannot penetrate. And when the world is as insanely woke as it is right now, you may find sleep harder to come by. This poem actually came to its author in a dream, and that would be impressive were it the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, but in fact it's just a quatrain, four lines, but a really cracking quatrain, published posthumously in 1939 by the Shropshire lad himself, A.E. Houseman. When the bells jostle in the tower, the hollow night amid, then on my tongue the taste is sour of all I ever did. That closing couplet is quite something, and there are multiple interpretations of what's going on there. But when I first read it, I thought it was just about sleeplessness. Somewhere the distant church bells have struck midnight. You're lying there ready for sleep, but sleep doesn't come. You're awake. You're alert to every nocturnal rustle from the flora and fauna, and the day you're ready to kiss off insists on lying heavy on you. On my tongue, the taste is sour of all I ever did. Because when you want to sleep, but you can't, the taste is sour. You think of what you should have said in that day's job interview, the witty riposte you might have delivered at dinner, the better deal you might have got from the car dealer, the girl who almost kind of sort of was inviting you to ask her to a movie, but you didn't say the right thing and the moment passed. On my tongue, the taste is sour of all I ever did. That's how it feels at 2 in the morning. And it's not just personal now. The taste is sour in a more general sense, don't you find? The first half of 2020 has been the weirdest time, as the world, or at least the bulk of our assumptions about it, is unravelling everywhere you look. So here's Keats. In that very productive year of just over 2 centuries ago, 1819, with a sonnet on sleeplessness, complete with an little opium allusion for those of you who dig the drug fiend scene. But as with A.E. Houseman, the taste of the day that won't quite end is sour on his tongue, and he wants soothest sleep to close his oh-so-willing eyes. By John Keats, A Sonnet to Sleep. O soft embalmer of the still midnight, shutting with careful fingers and benign our gloom-pleased eyes, embowered from the light, enshaded in forgetfulness divine. O soothe us sleep, if it so please thee, close in midst of this thine hymn my willing eyes, or wait the amen ere thy poppy throws around my bed its lulling charities. Then save me, or the passed day will shine upon my pillow, breeding many woes. Save me from curious conscience that still lords its strength for darkness, burrowing like a mole. Turn the key deftly in the oiled wards, and seal the hushed casket of my soul. A poem from Me to You by John Keats, A Sonnet to Sleep. One of my favourite musical conjurings of sleep is by the Danish composer Carl Nielsen, with words by Johannes Jørgensen. You may remember we use a bit of it in my audio presentation of Jack London's classic short story, To Build a Fire. I would like to portray sleep in music, wrote Nielsen to Jørgensen, a sort of hymn to its glory. Sleep heals all wounds and alleviates all troubles. It is the greatest good for all living creatures, and the blissful state where nothing is hard and palpable, but everything swims along in a long golden eternity. Sleep has its dreams, both good and bad, but they must each return to their own quarters, for sleep can be disturbed, but it never can be killed.
Sleep.
Sirwanen, Sleep, premiered in Copenhagen in 1905 and performed there by the Danish Radio Symphony Orchestra and Choir, conducted by Mogens Vuldiker. The Cambridge professor of post-colonial theory, gender, Marxism and critical race studies, Priyamvada Gopal, recently tweeted, "White lives don't matter and abolish whiteness," as a result of which she got promoted at Cambridge, after explaining that those tweets were, quote, "very clearly speaking to a structure and ideology, not about people." It's rather harder to make the same claim about her remark last year, that she has to fight very hard the urge to, quote, "kneecap white men." So in these times when post-colonial theory professors at Oxbridge like to talk about kneecapping their enemies, I thought we'd have a poem about apparently peaceable persons nevertheless desiring the death and destruction of others. John Betjeman was a very popular poet laureate in Britain, indeed a celebrity poet, which was rare then and rarer now. I had a slight acquaintanceship with Sir John, but knew very well his missus, Penelope Betjeman, who was so fond of her horse Moti that Lord Berners used to let her bring him into the drawing room for tea with them. Penelope and her husband became estranged after her conversion to Catholicism and his legover activities, but notwithstanding their separation, whenever I went round to see Penny Betch at their home in Chelsea, about half the time Sir John would be there, so they were very evidently amicably estranged, and that's when I'd have occasional conversations with him about his poetry. Penelope died in her beloved India, where her dad had been Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army, and she had spent her girlhood. She was in her late 70s, leading a group of riders on a horseback tour of the Himalayas, and just suddenly fell dead. And I think of her quite a bit, actually, often in connection with the age of one's friend's children. She was always astonished to discover that people she thought of as 8 or 9 were pushing middle age and now governor of the Turks and Caicos. And I can never quite get that. And now I do. Anyway, this is one of her husband's most famous poems, and some of you will be familiar with an oft-retailed line of mine. When I'm asked about transgender bathrooms or Confederate generals or the racism of Eskimo pie, and I say, this is what we'll be talking about when the Mullahs nuke us. And we all laugh, and then I think, what am I really saying there? Do I actually want the Mullahs to nuke us? Or more likely, the Chinese do their EMP attack and plunge us back to the mid-19th century, but with a population of whinging pyjama boys, feminist harridans and trans-stapo nutters who've managed to lose all the skills we took for granted in the mid-19th century, like how to shingle a roof. And I don't really relish that situation, but I can understand increasingly a despair with the age that leads one to welcome total devastation. Slough is a nondescript town near Windsor in Berkshire, and in the 1930s it became rather suddenly the home for factories that would be all too necessary in the coming World War. And with factories come housing estates. And suddenly a town and its environs are utterly transformed. There is a fair amount of snobbery toward the lower middle class here, remarkable for a poet whose parents, as Penelope's mum and dad complained, were in trade. But almost as soon as he'd written and published this poem, Betjeman felt bad about surrendering to the dark urge to rain down destruction on a modernity he loathed, especially after the bombs did actually start to fall on Slough a couple of years later, thanks to the Luftwaffe. On his centenary in 2006, their daughter, Candida Lysett Green, apologised to the people of Slough and said that her father bitterly regretted writing this poem, and she presented the town with a collection of her father's poetry inscribed with the improbable words, "We love Slough." First published in 1937 in the collection Continual Dew by John Betjeman, Slough. Come friendly bombs and fall on Slough. It isn't fit for humans now. There isn't grass to graze a cow. Swarm over, death. Come, bombs, and blow to smithereens those air-conditioned bright canteens. Tin fruit, tin meat, tin milk, tin beans, tin mines, tinned breath. Mess up the mess they call a town, a house for 97 down, and once a week a half a crown for 20 years. And get that man with double chin, who'll always cheat and always win, who washes his repulsive skin in women's tears. And smash his desk of polished oak, and smash his hand so used to stroke, and stop his boring dirty joke and make him yell. But spare the bald young clerks who add the profits of the stinking cad. It's not their fault that they are mad. They've tasted hell. It's not their fault they do not know the bird song from the radio. It's not their fault they often go to Maidenhead and talk of sport and makes of cars in various bogus Tudor bars and daren't look up and see the stars but belch instead. In labour-saving homes with care, their wives frizz out peroxide hair and dry it in synthetic air and paint their nails. Come friendly bombs and fall on Slough to get it ready for the plough. The cabbages are coming now. The earth exhales. A poem from Me to You by John Betjeman. Slough. With that great last line, the earth exhales. The snobbery about mock Tudor pubs and peroxide hair is present in a lot of the left's blather about white privilege and so on. Class condescension underpins the media's loathing of half the electorate. But as to the rest, the call to rain down Armageddon, those of us prone to such thoughts must not surrender to despair, to the belief that all is now so wrecked that only ruination from the skies can correct the situation. Still, I confess, there are times when I feel awfully sympathetic to Betjeman's scenario. I shall forbear to name any municipalities. But even Slough has its redeeming qualities. It has, for example, given us such eminent musicians as Alma Cogan, Ginger Spice of the Spice Girls, and a lady I loved listening to on her piano jazz show on America's National Public Radio for so many years, Marion McPartland. Here's Marion, scion of Slough, in not quite the Slough of Despond, but nevertheless a melancholy mood. Marion McPartland playing her own composition, Melancholy Mood. Here's a poem by W.H. Auden I've always liked. As a matter of fact, Stray Lines kept popping into my head over recent months, and it suddenly dawned that they were all from the same piece. It's called The Fall of Rome, but you realise early on that there are all kinds of anachronisms, like a clerk writing on a pink piece of paper. Obviously, they didn't have pink paper in the Roman Empire. So you think, well, Auden was writing this a couple of years after the Second World War. Maybe he had in mind Rome, capital of the Kingdom of Italy, which voted in June 1946 to abolish the monarchy and become a republic. Or maybe he was thinking of post-war Britain, whose imperial vulnerability and imperial overstretch the war had exposed through the Japanese occupation of Singapore and Burma and so forth. Or maybe he was thinking back to the Habsburg Empire 30 years earlier. Or maybe he was thinking of them all and positing a general theory of civilizational ruin. But whatever he had in mind, a lot of the imagery rings strangely familiar to our own time. Antifa mobs holed up in abandoned precinct houses is the merest variation on outlaws in mountain caves. The line, fantastic grow the evening gowns, could stand for the red carpet pre-show on any lousy awards night of activist celebrities. Revenue agents pursuing tax absconders through the sewers of provincial towns are the feds of the Russia investigation, doing their show me the man and I'll show you the process crime routine and showing up at dawn in the full RoboCop. And the mutinying Marines are those Atlanta and Minneapolis coppers failing to turn up, walking off the job, opting for early retirement. So a lot of weirdly familiar imagery in this poem, working up to a penultimate verse which sounds like it came from a mayoral press conference. First published in 1947 and dedicated to dear old Cyril Connolly by W.H. Auden, The Fall of Rome. The piers are pummeled by the waves. In a lonely field, the rain lashes an abandoned train. Outlaws fill the mountain caves. Fantastic grow the evening gowns. Agents of the fisc pursue, absconding tax defaulters through the sewers of provincial towns. Private rites of magic send the temple prostitutes to sleep. All the literati keep an imaginary friend. Cerebrotonic Cato may extol the ancient disciplines, but the muscle-bound marines mutiny for food and pay. Caesar's double bed is warm as an unimportant clerk writes, I do not like my work, on a pink official form. Unendowed with wealth or pity, little birds with scarlet legs, sitting on their speckled eggs, eye each flu-infected city. Altogether elsewhere, vast herds of reindeer move across, miles and miles of golden moss, silently and very fast. A poem, From Me to You, by W.H. Auden, The Fall of Rome. And notice, until we get to those last two stanzas about how basically each quatrain contrasts something that's still staggering on with something falling apart elsewhere, the contrast, until we get to those two ultimate stanzas and that line about birds eyeing each flu-infected city, and then the final quatrain about what's going on altogether elsewhere, the herds of reindeer on the move. In other words, we in Rome must fall with Rome, for we made our choices. But altogether elsewhere, there are creatures and men who made other choices, and our fall is not theirs. Both the close-up, the birds in the flu-infected cities, and the panoramic view, the reindeer far from Rome, remind us that, as always, the wider world is utterly indifferent to our self-inflicted catastrophe.
The Mark Stein Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.